Last week, we released the first part of a two-part episode.
And that remote nation is the only nation where children as young as 4 or 5 years old, the first lesson being taught to them is to run to a bomb shelter.
If you haven't heard the first part of our discussion, you can find it on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Hope you enjoy. We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
Here I am.
And here I am.
And here I am. We shall David I.
The liberals went through the roof. They called Bloomberg and the commissioner all the name. They filed all the lawsuits, everything, which is fine. For me, it's fine. Democracy, democracy. But for me, business as usual, unacceptable. 9/11 is a defining moment. It's a game changer. And people who caused 9/11 need to be known. Every single connection, aspect, anything, whatever that motivated them, we need to know it and we need to eliminate it. And that was the job. And the liberals went crazy and they put Bloomberg to hell. And now, after Muslim profiling, a lot of lawsuits, New York Times, because they needed also to be awarded. They received a lot of awards for their nonsensical mislabeling. And then they attach profiling to stop and frisk. Because again, stop and frisk on the Bloomberg went to the roof. But again, I was with Bloomberg. Why? Because I live in the Bronx. I'm an African. I'm a Muslim. In the 90s, every Friday, we lay 3, 4, 5 dead bodies because they were cab drivers or they were street vendors. Killed because of the violence, drug dealing, gangs, and all these things. So for me, any tactic that will prevent these deaths and destructions, I support it. That's why I was not too critical about stop and frisk. And also, my justification was, let's look at the numbers. Who are the victims of crime in New York City? 94% or 95% blacks and Latinos. Who are the perpetrators? 98% blacks and Latinos. Now, you want the police to send the police officers to the white community to stop and frisk. Who they stop frisk? They're not committing crime. You got to send police officers where crime is taking place, where people are being victimized. So, but anyway.
But I want to to point out something.
Yeah.
You know, and of course, I completely agree with you. I don't call myself liberal, conservative. The whole labels.
Yeah,
It's just a label. But if we take this group of people that call themselves liberals, you mentioned the New York Times, the New York Times readers, the people that call Bloomberg, the people that give themselves awards, they are majority non-black.
Yes.
And non-Muslim.
Yes.
And they are coming. What will they say when they see you, a black Muslim imam, saying, no, this is okay. What you're saying, liberals, is wrong. How would they react?
No, they're confused. Like, even now they're confused. I confuse the far right. They say, oh my God, he's one of us. I'm not one of you. I speak in relation to what we may have in common, but I'm not one of you. Then the far left, they completely don't know who I am. They don't know what I am. They until today, they're very, very confused. But the thing is that, for me, whether you accept my point of view, but one thing that everybody, even my first, they always understand that it's come from a principle. You see, I don't just talk. I'm not people haters. I don't hate anybody. Even when I say liberals and whatever, I don't hate them. Even the so-called pro-Palestinian, they build websites, put my picture, and say that this person must be eliminated. You know, for the past 20 years, how many death threats and boycott, whatever. I don't hate them. Even now, when I go to their meetings, you think we're friends like this. There's no hatred in my heart. Nothing. I don't agree with you because I may think you're crazy, but that doesn't mean I hate you. I don't have any person I totally hate. I just hate you. No, I don't have that. I disagree with you. I disagree with the way you see things. I disagree, whatever. I disagree with you. But that doesn't mean that I hate you. And then even the liberals who are so confused about me because all the positions that I talk about, you know, they said, I mean, this guy is an immigrant. This guy is poor. This guy is black. This guy is Muslim. All these things. But yet, my position, because, you know, You know, some people are crazy, and there are a lot of crazy people in the so-called you know, far left people. They're socialists. They're crazy. So, but I don't hate them.
Are you? I have to ask this. You know, I hope it's not too much, but are you not afraid of a fatwa?
Do you not have any fatwa done on me? You haven't checked. I am one of the primary target of, because there are a lot of anti-Semites in the Muslim world. No, there are a lot of anti-Semites in the world, but in the Muslim world, there are a lot of anti-Semites. Most of them are ignorant of the facts, because for the past 70 years, there has not been a single issue so profoundly marketed in the Muslim world like the Palestinian cause. This is the number one cause. Some Muslims would rather not pray than be pro-Israel or not. They wouldn't identify the Palestinian cause than even anything else. That is how profound the Palestinian cause is to the Muslim community. It is not, it is deeper than what most people realize. And that's why, I talked to the Israeli government and I talked to the thing and I said, I think I'm in the know there, because I'm a Muslim and I deal with Muslims and I know the sentiment and the strong feeling of the Muslims, and I want to help you. There are certain things that you must do. One of the things that the Israeli government must do, and I know they're not going to do, but must do. You remember a couple of years ago, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, whatever, they wanted to go to Palestine, whatever.
Yeah.
Allow them to go. It's a mistake for Israel to deny them access. You know what happened is this. We have an Islamic scholar who was deemed one of the biggest anti-Semites because of, you know, the prevalence of anti-Semitic in the Muslim world. And God bless him to happen to travel to Israel for whatever. I don't know how he went, whatever. But he went not only 1 week, but I think he spent for 1 month. Today, he's the biggest promoter of Israel. Democracy, independent, liberty. He couldn't believe what he saw, what he experienced in Israel. Went to these hospitals, so many student doctors from Africa, from other places. Went to some other hospitals, so many Palestinian patients. And what he saw, he thought was not possible. He thought that Israel, Jews and Muslims, Jews and Palestinians were like this, don't talk to each other, whatever. Then when he went there, saw what Israel was about, it completely changed him. So what I'm saying to Israeli government, you're making a mistake. Ilhan Omar could be your worst enemy. Let her come. Ilhan Omar, let her come. Because a lot of these things are ignorance, and ignorance is deadly. Because now, if you dance in their drum, and if you deny them, now you're dancing in their drum. Let them go, because they're not going to go to Gaza. And if they did go to Gaza, they say, oh, you know,
back.
I want to go back to Michigan. So let them go. And also, the Muslim scholars sponsor us, many imams and Muslim scholars, to go to Israel. You want to spend money for bombs and whatever? No, spend it. Give them a plane full of imams. Let them go there. Invest in common sense. And that's what I tell them. And you will see what happens. But because in the Muslim world, Israel is number one enemy. And because Israel is number one enemy, the Muslim, a lot of Muslims are anti-Semite. They say, oh, you know, we're not anti-Semite. We're just anti-Zionism. Well, then you're anti-Semite. But that's what they tell you. No, we're not. We love Jewish people. Whatever. You know, Allah said this and that and that. But deep inside, they're anti-Semite. So, but that also can, you know, because Israel represents asset, not liability. Israel is a beautiful model of from nothing to something big. You know, even when you go to the agricultural sector, whatever, the tech, whatever, these are all valuable, you know, innovation that is so beneficial and so inspirational. Bring all your enemy to come and see it, and let them see it, and then you will see what happens. By the way, the first time I went to Israel, I was surprised too, because to me, even though I was never anti-Semite, but I was not pro-Israel before. But when I went there, and I said, wait a minute. Is this Israel or this different place? It completely changed me. And now I'm one of the biggest promoters of Israel. And by the way, what I'm doing here is small. What I'm doing to normalize Israel in the Muslim world officially completely different. I have complete media network that is utilized to communicate with Muslim leaders to normalize relations with Israel. That is my contribution.
I want to talk about many of your other things. One thing people don't realize, there's two words of it to describe you.
Troublemaking.
I like that. I'd say activist yeah. and entrepreneur.
Yes.
A lot of people are activists or want to be activists. They don't know how to start. You don't know how to stop. So I'm going to throw different things. There's a lot. So just tell me, like, just what is each one of those things?
Yeah.
What is the Peace December movement?
Peace December movement was launched because in the 2000, right after the, after 2000, because before 2000, there were a lot of people say, oh, the world's going to end. Well, yeah. The world did not end. But anyway, after that, in New York, there were heightened anti-Semitism, and there were heightened anti-LGBTQ, and there were a lot of bias attacks, you know. And then I said, no, we're New Yorkers. We're one New York family. There has to be a way where we embrace our diversity. We don't have to agree with people's lifestyle, people's faith, people's priority. That is not diversity. That is, diversity is we come from different angle. We like different things. We believe in different things. But yet, we have one thing in common. We're all human beings. And we also have another thing in common. We are all New Yorkers, or we all whatever. And those things are not separable. You cannot separate one human being from another, no matter what the color, race, whatever. We're all one human being. So I convened so many strategy meetings to find out how can we bring peace? How can we embrace diversity, bring peace in New York? How can a Muslim imam or a clergy can have a good relationship with LGBTQ member without accepting? You know, by the way, I'm a Muslim. I'm an imam. I'm not saying this is right. No. But I said, this is who you are. You have the right to it. And I, as somebody who values democracy and freedom and liberty, I will support your protection of what you believe and who you are. Do I agree with it? No. But this is your priority. This is your value. If I deny your value, then I'm automatically denying my value. Then guess what? We have jungle. Therefore, I don't agree with you, but because I value the democracy we share, then I will do whatever to protect you so that you can enjoy whomever you are, wherever you are. That was the idea in my head after that. I said, we don't have to agree. We don't have to accept, but we have to find a common ground. So one of the strategy meetings, what do we do, this and that? And then all of a sudden, we said, okay, let's make 1 month of peace. And then originally I call it Jesus month, because to me, I said, well, this is they call it a Judeo-Christian nation. Let's call it the Jesus, Priest of Peace. Let's take December. Some people celebrate as a Christmas, Jesus' birthday, not everybody, but at least. So we call it, I put together something and I gave it to somebody, a great writer, who took it to another level and wrote the whole concept of Peace December. And then we circulated, but then ADL, there was a girl who worked for ADL, Anti-Defamation League. I always forget her name. She read it. She said, you know what? The concept is beautiful. I love it. But we have to change the name. Jesus month. Because you're Muslim. Right. I said, yeah. You're not Christian. I'm a Jew. I'm not Christian. So then let's make it more universal. So we move it from Jesus month to Peace December.
Peace December. I love that.
So and then Peace December now is being celebrated in 23 countries, where December is regarded as a peace month.
Will you invite me for next December?
Absolutely. In New York, we organize events dedicated to peace and the cessation of conflict and violence. And we promote hate. Again, we embrace diversity. You know, you have Christians and Jews and Muslims and atheists and, you know, straight people, gay people, whatever, but we're all one New York family. Let's embrace that diversity and the beauty and the protection without accepting everybody's lifestyle. For example, a rabbi once told me, he said that I love you, you're my friend, but when I come to you, I don't pray in your masjid. I'm not Muslim. And when you come to me, I don't expect you to come to the synagogue and do what I do. But we are human beings. We are New Yorkers. We love each other. And that is the relationship that we need to build. You don't come to people and then do what they do. You know, you maintain your independence. You maintain your value. But, you know, what we have in common is our humanity.
For people listening, wait, there's more. What is the Community Peace Patrol Officers program?
Yes, Community Peace Patrol Officers. I am in the Bronx. Bronx is pretty much known to be number one for all things bad, last for all things good. You name it. Education, violence, crime, poverty, broken homes, homelessness, failed dreams, you name it. Bronx number one. And because of that, you have a lot of children who come out of broken homes, single family homes, and they have no hope. They have no sound economic background. And a lot of them don't have sound spiritual background. They have nothing. And guess what they gravitate to? Gang. As young as 11 years old, find home within the gang affiliation. They love them, they protect them, and they have camaraderie. So that became a very destructive lifestyle. So I said, no, we, the parents, the adults, the teachers, we, the grown-up, must create an environment where not law enforcement, but us, the grassroots, must provide the security. So we created the Peace Patrol. So we patrol the housing projects. We have a program where we remove more gang members than anybody can ever imagine, because we have a very effective program where we reason with them. A lot of them, I'm like uncle to them. They trust me because I never betray them. I don't snitch on anything. But I walk them through, path that is healthier, safer, better. And, if they, drop of high school or whatever, I connect them to where they continue on the education. If they college dropout, if they don't have job, whatever they think, they are resources that I can connect them so that their life will not be the same. So that's how we remove them. Because you can condemn it, but if you don't provide them with the solution, if they are in a neighborhood where they either have to be gang members or become casual to gang members, you're not helping them. But if there are ways where you can, protect them, they will not be gang members. So the Community Peace Patrol Officer was primarily housing project patrol / mentoring.
What is Adopt a Friend?
Adopt a Friend. Adopt a Friend came was founded in June 2004. Adopt a Friend was founded in 2004 because after 9/11, I said I study the causes of 9/11, and all led me to the Holy Land. Because all the criminals in Islamic religion, all of them, the terrorists, the criminals, the anti-Semites, the savages, you name it, the worst of the worst, they all use the Holy Land, the Palestinian cause, to do what they do. They justify it, and all of them. So Israel is a small devil. America that supports Israel is a big devil. That's what they call it. And therefore, hurting Israel and hurting America is all good, because that's all part of it. And so I hosted meetings. I said, no, we're going to create an organization that bring Muslims and Jews visibly together. This way, those who are promoting anti-Semitism, when they see Muslims and Jews visibly doing things together, they will say, wait a minute, is he Muslim? And by the way, a lot of people say, oh, are you Muslim? Because of what I do. So that's how I say, no, we adopt each other. So that's how Adopt a Friend organization came, primarily to bring Muslims and Jews visibly doing things together for people to see. Now it became a non-profit organization that does so many other social services and education, a lot of things. But the genesis of it was bring Muslims and Jews together visibly, not just whatever, because a lot of things are being done behind the scene. But for me, I don't do things behind the scene. That's why I speak up. Immediately after October 7, I was the only one speaking. And people, I was writing and speaking because I want to be visible, because there are a lot of people who may feel the way I feel, but they're intimidated, or they feel like, oh, no, I don't know. So that's why I speak for them. And a lot of them privately, they say to me, oh, you know what? I don't want to be public, but I agree with you.
Yeah.
So I become their spokesperson. So that's what, you know, adopt a friend. I just wanted to do something visible dealing with the Jewish community, especially, you know, 4 years, 3 years after 9/11, so that those who are promoting isolationism and, you know, separation and division, they say, oh, no, that masjid or that center, where you go there, you see Jews and Muslims and whatever. And, you know, in that process, we also brought in a synagogue there. So now we had synagogue and a mosque in the same building. Muslims went crazy. They organized boycott. Almost 90% of our people left because we had the synagogue there, the Jewish people come. But then a year later, it was in reverse.
More people came. And you hosted a synagogue.
In the masjid. In the building, same building.
For 10 years, right?
Yeah. Because again, we wanted to show visible. This was also a symbolic thing because we don't want to do anything behind the scene. Less so when these people said, Jews this, Israelis do whatever, you said, no. You're crazy.
And just to be clear for people listening, it wasn't just any synagogue. It's like it's a very orthodox Jewish congregation with payas, with the hat, with everything. There are amazing pictures seeing you with the Orthodox community, and it is. It's visible.
Absolutely, yeah.
What is Halal Finder?
Okay, Halal Finder. Actually, there's a new... Halal Finder, you know, I'm an entrepreneur. And I was on Wall Street when internet started. I was an investment banker. So I was there in the beginning. And when the ICANN, which manages the internet, was giving the top level domains, .com, .org, .info, .edu, whatever. So I say, I'm a Muslim. We consume halal, .halal. So I asked them, I said, when will you open the window again for people to sponsor top level domains? They said, I think 2012, maybe 5 years later, whatever, 6 years later. And I said, okay, I want to sponsor .halal. Because, you know, Muslims, you know, we're the largest, whatever. And they told me what to do. So I was preparing. 2012 came, the window opened. I was the first applicant, sponsored, put the deposit, whatever. And then what I did was, intentionally, I said, I don't have the money. I don't have the technical how. I know what I want, but I don't have the technical. So what I would do now, let me advertise it. What I do, I knew that top-level domains, you cannot trademark it. But I know that when you file trademark, at that time, it will be global. And I filed it immediately. The same day, it went viral. Everywhere. They said, a Muslim group in New York, they're, you know, planning to apply for that halal so that... And then it went viral, went everywhere. So I was getting contacts and whatever. Who are you? And what were there? A lot of things. And then one organization in Iran, you know, read it and then they love it. And then they had office in Turkey. They had the money, whatever. And then they also apply. So they had money, they had things. So when they apply, and I know I cannot compete with them, you know, I withdraw my apply. And so they went ahead. But when they went ahead, they did everything, pay all the money. But because they are Shia, it's very small. And now the Saudi Arabia and India and the United Arab Emirates find out that, you know, they think so, they put a stop to it. They say because they don't represent us. There's very small percentage of the Muslim world and they didn't consult us, so they stop it. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, well, I was the original applicant. Now I'm going to take. So that's how Halal Finder came. So now we're working on it. So the next year, ICANN is opening the window and I will be the applicant again. That's how Halal Finder.
What do you do on the website on the Halal Finder?
We want to centralize all things halal. Because if you go to Europe, a lot of people think, halal, only halal meat. Like when you go to Europe, 60-something percent of halal consumers are non-Muslim. 80% of halal producers are non-Muslim. So it's a universal thing. Halal is different from kosher because kosher is more restricted, whatever. But halal is pretty much mainstream. A lot of things about halal, and a lot of people don't know. Halal market is the largest. It's over $2 trillion market. So now we want to centralize it. We want to work with majority Muslim nations. It's not so that when it opens next year, they approve that halal, so that when you register your business, if you're selling halal, then rather than .com, it will be that halal.
Finally, one last thing. You founded the Islamic Leadership School for Muslims.
Yes.
What's that?
Yeah. As an activist, you know, when I came here, 1986, and in the mid-80s, coming to the 90s, that's where majority of West Africans were coming to the United States. A lot of the West Africans were going to France, but United States in the mid-80s, 90s. Before that, only students and diplomats and rich people. But the masses of migration happened in the mid-80s and 90s. So I came 1986. And then, because they were coming. So later on, I was exposed to unacceptable reality that the West Africans were having. When I say West Africans, I really don't include like the Niger. I'm specifically saying the Francophone West Africans, because they're the newer one. Senegalese and Ivorians and Malians and whatever. So they were having a hard time getting apartment. So, as an activist, I said, you know, the Africans cannot get apartments in New York City, so people are discriminating against us, and I want to fight it. So they said, well, if you want to fight it, you got to go to real estate. I said, what is real estate? They said, that's a place where they sell homes and rent apartments. And I said, can you direct me to one? So somebody was able to give me one real estate office in the Bronx. So one day I walk in there, I said, you know, I'm an African, and, you know, the Africans are getting, you know, shorthanded because they don't get apartment, blah, blah, and I want to fight it. I want you to help me fight it. And the guy was laughing to them, the broker was laughing to them and said, okay, become an agent. I said, how do I become an agent? Then whatever, I became an agent there, to make the long story short. So when I became an agent there, I was sitting here. Behind me was a lady who would become my mother-in-law. So her daughter was in high school then. And then we started working there. And then I was very religious. And she was so fascinated with me because I was young, but I was religious. So everywhere she goes, she said, I want you to drive me here. I was her bodyguard pretty much. We worked together. So when her daughter graduated and went to college, the same year the daughter graduated from college, I went to Wall Street. I left real estate, went to Wall Street. And then one day she called me. She said, you know, my daughter graduated from banking and finance, and you're in banking finance. Can you find my daughter a job? And I said, okay. So the first time she gave me her home number and I talked, the daughter called me, we talk. And well, obviously later on she said that was the worst thing she ever did. But anyway, so not only did I find a job, but we got married. So when we were getting married, that was 1990 we met, 1996 we got married. 1996 we got married. When we were getting married, God is my witness, only one prenuptial agreement we had. That was, should we get married and God give us children, then I'm going to go to public schools. She said, I agreed. That was the only prenuptial agreement. Now, we got married. We got our first daughter the year later. And 3 years later, 3 years, pre-K, now time, because this is our agreement. We're not going to send our children to public schools because these drug infested gangs and failures and whatever. We don't want to be part of it. And so what do we do? Well, we have to have a school for our daughter.
So you started a school.
We started a school.
Because you needed a school for your children.
Because we needed a school for our children. And then we went to Long Island. We went to New Jersey. We went so many different places. There were Islamic school there. Some of them we liked. Some of them we didn't like. But there was an Islamic school in Long Island. Progressive Muslims, beautiful people, nice, brand new, everything. So we love it and they love us to death because one of the leaders was our accountant. So we said, okay, we're going to be here. They have already the masjid, the school, the community. So they wanted us to move there and we agreed. And there was a home, almost brand new home, built by two doctors. right next to the masjid, and then they wanted us to have the home. They said, even if you don't have the whole thing, you know, we will work with you. That's how much they love us. And then we agreed. So we wanted to move there so that our daughter, and if we have more, we'll go there. So one day we went to the home to see it, beautiful home in Long Island. But on our way back to the Bronx, something hit me. On our way, I said to my wife, no, I'm going to stop because I'm thinking something. We stop on a service road. I said to my wife, we're not moving to Long Island. She said, what? I said, no, we're not moving to Long Island. We're in the Bronx. We're Muslims. If this is a major concern of us to protect our daughter, and there are a lot of Muslims growing up now in the Bronx, let's find a way where we can also do the same thing for them. This way we're not going to be selfish. Let's go build a school in the Bronx. Say, are you crazy? You don't know anything about education. Nothing. I say, but we're going to do it. And thus, we completely canceled Long Island. We went to the Bronx, talked to people, bought a building, and then talked to educators, be able to put the team, build the curriculum, get the everything, open the school. And the school
opened. And your wife was the principal.
And guess what day the school opened? 9/11. The same day. Our opening day was 9/11.
Wow.
We were there after, you know, publicity. Oh, the first Muslim school in the Bronx. You know, everything. The night of September 10 going September 11. We had a lot of volunteers cleaning up and putting this, putting that, because we didn't have a lot of students. And people were excited but anxious because it's the first time. And some of them actually slept there. They said, because they were painting here, cleaning there, slept there. And then dawn, we got a prayer fajr. And then around 7 o'clock, official school. We had the meeting, beautiful meeting. Then, you know, we started the school. Then I think around 8:45, whatever, the assistant principal started receiving calls saying, you crazy? They're bombing New York City. She didn't pay money. He said, no, nobody can bomb New York City. Then the calls coming from all of frantic people, friends. And then she came to me and said, Brother Musa, I think something is going on in New York. Can you check, watch the TV? So I went to the office, put the TV on. As soon as I put the TV on, I saw what was going on. You know, I'm a Wall Street guy. I know the place very well. I watched it for like 1 minute. And I said, what? But because I knew they were going to bomb it before. So it was not like completely out of the blue. They did that 98 or 9 whatever. So, and I said, okay. I put it off. I call everybody to come to have emergency meeting. And I told them they're bombing New York City. And I said to them, 9 out of 10 times, it will be Muslims. Because they tried before. They didn't succeed. And if it's happening again, it's Muslims. Today's our opening day. Now, this is a decisive moment for us. I want every one of you to give your input. What should we do? Should we close? Should we open? Almost all of them, including some of the students, volunteer, parents, they say, no, we have to close. It's too dangerous and be people going to come and attack, whatever. After they finished, I said, I thank you for your input, but we're not closing. This is our opening day. And I'm telling you, it will be a tie to our religion. And if we're opening, then we owe it to the public to tell them who we are versus who they are. Let us be the spokesperson now for this. And that's what we did. Nobody left. We run the school and the media found out. We had as much media in the Bronx as you have in 9/11. If you go back to the early footages, every time you see Al-Qaeda, them, whatever, on one half of the screen, the other one is me. check. We never close.
Incredible.
And I said, not only do we close, but now we're going to open 24 hours. Let everybody come. So the media from all over the world, Europe, everywhere are coming. With the first 2 years, we were the spokesperson. And it was the best contribution. So from there, you know, we decided that our opening day was 9/11. God sent us a message to not only create, you know, academics and spiritual, but also peace building. And then the very first component that we attached to the school was, I went to the Holocaust Memorial Museum and I proposed to them to have a program. And I didn't know what the program is. I just said that, you know, you're here as a result of Holocaust. There's a 9/11. We open school, let's find something. And through the conversation, they came up with a program called Interfaith Living Museum, where you have fifth graders from Muslim schools and fifth graders from Jewish schools. So four schools, fifth graders, powerful program, year long. At the end of the program, they graduate at the Holocaust Memorial Museum, and then each child create two books, the book of menu and the book of artifacts. Powerful. Until now, the program is ongoing. Yeah. Even the former Israel, a lot of Israeli former diplomats and leaders, their children graduate from the program. That's how powerful the program until now is going.
I could speak with you for hours, but we have to finish. We finish with what I call the Here I Am lightning round. It's just a series of questions.
No problem.
Rapid fire. The first thing that comes to mind.
No problem.
All right, Musa Drame, what is one thing people don't know about you?
I may be very confusing because of who I am, where I belong, and my position on things. I'm very, in one hand, I'm very liberal, and in other hand, I'm very conservative. I'm socially conservative, but at the same time, very liberal. I would say that I'm socially conservative, but I'm also very embracing of diversity.
What is one thing people don't know about Muslims?
That Islam is not what the majority of Muslims are practicing. That is one thing. There's Islam and there's what Muslims practice. So I call them Quranic-based Islam versus Hadith-based Islam. Muslims practice Hadith-based Islam and Quran-based Islam. It's very small. What is small percentage of Muslims practice? The day that the majority of Muslims practice Quran-based, no more anti-Semitism, no more anti-Israel, no more violence, less misogyny, no more problem. Islam will become a beautiful platform. So that's one thing Muslims don't know, that what majority of Muslims are practicing is Hadith-based Islam.
When was the last time you cried?
I just almost cried here, describing four-year-old Israeli children running to bomb shelters. Every time that I think about it, talk about it, I cry. So the last time that I cried was Friday, last Friday, and I told them this is the reason why I cried last Friday. We were talking about what is Ramadan, the benefit of Ramadan, and I was telling, I said I have a friend who came from Jordan, originally from Palestine, but among those kicked out, and they in Jordan, so, you know, Miss Jordan, and established businessman, entrepreneur, successful, very successful here, have a lot of things. One day he went to Jordan, and he gave one of the local imams just $100 to the local imams, nothing big. And a couple of weeks later, the imam's wife, you know, when the imam's wife met with my friend's wife, the imam's wife confided in her that the money that your husband gave my husband afforded us meat for a long time. We didn't have anything to eat meat, but that $100 gave us the luxury to eat meat.
That was emotional.
Yeah.
If you could be invited over for Shabbat dinner with any Jewish person in history, dead or living, who would that be?
You know, believe it or not, but there is the former Israeli prime minister, the liberal one. What's his name? You remember they had this agreement, him and the other one, prime minister, one year, the other one.
Yeah, Yair Lapid.
Yeah. So that because I listened to him so many times, and I like his background, and I also like his politics.
What is your favorite holiday?
My favorite holiday, believe it or not, is Christmas. You know why? A lot of food, a lot of celebration, a lot of lights. I love Christmas. I love Christmas season.
What is your least favorite holiday?
My least favorite holiday. Do I have least favorite holiday? I don't know, actually. I don't know any least favorite holiday.
When do you feel safest?
That's You know, actually, that's a very good question, because I'm not saved. Because my life has always been on edge, you know, because I'm very outspoken and I offend so many people and groups. And I'm always on the edge and always, including this thing. So therefore, my safest, maybe when I'm sleeping.
Mm. Yeah. So I think the next question is, when do you feel least safe?
Whenever something brews in the Holy Land, whenever intifada brews, whenever something happens in the Holy Land, because everybody know that I will be speaking either on TV or in the paper. So my most dangerous moments is whenever something happens in the Holy Land, not in Africa, not in New York, but of all the places in the Holy Land, because of my position, my visible position, and sometimes my, I would say, almost soul position, and the fact that I'm brave enough to face it head on. Just like October 7, the way I was speaking, people, that they're going to murder you, they're going to murder you. And I said, no, God is the one who's going to murder me, and whatever. So that is my least safest moment, whenever something happened there.
What gives you hope?
Yes. What gives me hope is, as I told you, I was part of the commercialization of the internet. And I have seen the power of global connection afforded by technology. I have seen, I went to East Africa, and I've seen what mobile banking did to the villages in Africa, where women cannot read their names, but yet they can transact, they can get the money sent through their mobile phone, that I don't know. So that the way technology is globalizing our thinking gives me great hope, because now those who were oppressed, those who were marginalized, those who did not have access, have greater access. Islam, for example, there are so many movements now whose eyes are wide open because of, you know, people like me on social whatever that are speaking and language that they never heard. Because, you know, so many people were so caught up to their own cocoons. All they hear is echo chamber situation. But technology changed that. And I'm very, very grateful that no matter how dangerous technology, AI, whatever, the opportunity could not have been greater. So my hope lies in the technical advancement that, you know, God affords us these days.
Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel, the Jewish diaspora, or the world in general. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
You know, we went to Israel, and we went to Israel and we went to Palestine. And then we visited a school called Hand in Hand in Israel. And with all the threats against them, with all the challenges, with all the divisive rhetoric, with all the problems affecting peaceful coexistence, they're trying their best, bringing Arab kids and Jewish kids, studying Hebrew, English, Arabic, and normalizing the coexistence, and try to the best of their ability to really numb the hatred and the weird different type of messaging. And I think if there's any endeavor that I want the whole world to put billions of dollars, will be Hand in Hand.
And how can people help you or your congregation, your mosque?
We usually, you see, the reason why for me, don't send me a penny. I'm an independent person. I've never ever taken money from any organization, any politics, or nothing. I'm completely an independent person. I said what I believe. I do what I believe. I go where I want to go. Therefore, I don't need your money. All I want to do is open your mind, open your heart, and see things the way they must be seen, and know one thing. We are all the same, because as I'm speaking to you here today, there are over 100 3,000 fellow Americans who are registered on the organ donation list, over 103,000. And not a single one of them care about race, gender, economic status, religion, or zip code. You know what they all care? A donor that matches so they can survive. So if you want to help me, see everybody as your brother and your sister. And do for them what you would do for yourself. And stop stereotyping, generalizing, and stop hating people because of what you are told. We are all the same, and nobody's special. Human beings is special, but not a single group, no matter what religion, what ethnicity, where they come from, they're just same as anybody else. And that is what I want you to help me. Don't send me a penny. I'm an independent. I don't want to be controlled by anybody. I want to do what I want to do. That's why I'm an entrepreneur. I'm an orphan. I'm a self-reliance, self-supporter, and self-sufficiency. Whether it is small or big, it is mine, and I'm happy about it. And I have a very successful life, despite all the other challenges.
Well, this was one of the most fascinating conversations I've had. And I also want to remind the audience that you're now fasting for Ramadan. So yes. Ramadan Mubarak.
Thank you.
And I'm just grateful to say, here I am with Imam Musa Drame. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure, and I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at The Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."